That is the sound of the first vocalization by Mickey Mouse in the movies in his film Steamboat Willie, produced by Walt Disney nearly 80 years ago. And from those beginnings sprang a revolution in animated films, and later a revolution in other entertainment, such as theme parks, and the beginnings of a media empire with a specific view of America to bring to the world. That's what Walt Disney, who died 40 years ago last Friday, is remembered for. There's a new biography of Walt Disney out now, Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination, and we'll be talking to its author today on the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jim Meadows, filling in for Celeste Quinn this hour of the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. And Neil Gabler, welcome to the show with us.
Thank you very much.
You know, you opened your book with it, so I might as well open the interview with it. Did Walt Disney arrange to have his body cryogenically frozen for possible resuscitation, according to the urban legend?
No, the answer is he did not. As I say in the book, it was fire, not ice, that claimed Walt Disney. He was cremated shortly after he died, and his ashes were interred in the Forest Lawn Cemetery in Glendale, California, where, if you're really intrepid, you can actually find them. He is as inconspicuous in death as he was conspicuous in life. He is actually buried behind a holly tree, and the plaque that bears only the words Walter Elias Disney is obscured by that holly tree, but there he is, if one wanted to find him.
Now, I do want to bring this up. As I remember it, an earlier biography of Disney by Mark Elliott, as I remember it, seems to say that Disney at least considered the idea of being cryogenically frozen.
Did you find it? I see no evidence that he ever considered it. I went through all of his papers. I had the privilege given to me by the Walt Disney Company, and I hasten to add that there was no quid pro quo for that. They didn't vet the manuscript, didn't pressure me or influence me in any way, but I had the privilege of going through all of his papers, and I saw nothing in his papers that indicates any interest in cryogenics. Certainly no desire to have himself frozen. So there are animators at the studio, one of whom, Ward Kimball, was something of a puckish fellow and loved to advance the idea that Walt had been cryogenically frozen, I think just to pull the public's leg. But I saw no evidence anywhere that he was even interested in it.
So you think Mark Elliott may have taken some of that joking around a little too seriously?
He may have. You know, there are, as I say, there are people at the studio who try to give that credence, but I don't see any evidence for it.
Does the fact that some of us are willing to believe that about Walt Disney, that he had himself frozen, or think it's an interesting idea considering the man, does that tell us anything about Walt Disney's role in American culture?
Oh, I think it tells us a great deal. I mean, one thing it tells us is how unwilling we were to give him up. We didn't want to surrender Walt Disney. We want the idea that this reassuring, genial figure, who for so many years and for several generations seemed to serve as the very emblem of American wholesomeness, could die. I mean, no one wants to believe that. I think it also speaks to Walt Disney's belief in perfection, which is something, a theme that runs through his films. I think it also speaks to his belief in technology. Because though many people regard Walt Disney as a great nostalgist, who always harkens back to the turn of the century, in point of fact, Walt Disney was also a great futurist. He made the Man in Space series on Disneyland television program. He made Our Friend the Atom. He was always looking toward cutting-edge technology. So there are many things that are kind of embedded in this myth that Walt Disney is frozen.
Your new biography, as I look through it, and I had previously looked at some of the earlier Disney biographies, seems to be the most meticulously researched book. You talk about having no problem having access to the Disney archives. And as I look back, it seems like the Disney Company was once a little more defensive about things. There is at least one book, which is a totally authorized biography, that actually carries the studio copyright. Why were they so open with you?
You know, that's a great question, and it's one which I cannot answer definitively. I applied for access to the archives, and it took nearly 2 years for that request to wend its way through the bureaucracy and for me to get an answer back, which was that they were going to grant me access. What I was told when I went to California and they requested a meeting with me after they already granted me access, was number one, that because Walt Disney had been dead for so long, and you pointed out on December 15th, it was 40 years, that was his 40th death anniversary, there was now time to have some perspective on Walt Disney. You know, earlier than that, there wasn't much perspective on him. He was right at the middle of a kind of cultural war between those who believe that Walt Disney represented everything wholesome and good in American culture and those who believe that he represented the very debasement of American culture. To some extent, that debate actually is still being waged. Secondly, and I say this in all modesty, they felt that there were only a handful of people who might be able to do the job on Walt Disney, and they knew my work, and they felt that I might be one of those individuals. So I can only take them at their word. I also have heard, however, and I've only heard this kind of through the grapevine, never directly, that Roy E. Disney, Walt's nephew, and the son of Roy O. Disney, Walt's brother and partner, was instrumental in gaining me access to the material because he felt that it was time now for a big, serious, fully annotated, full-scale biography of Walt Disney. And here's the interesting thing, Jim. You know, he's been dead for 40 years, but no one has written a full-scale, fully annotated biography until mine. There were biographies, but no full-scale, fully annotated biography.
And you mentioned about the differing, very firm views that people have about the Disney movies. I think the very first biography, Richard Schickel's the Disney version, essentially takes the anti-view.
Yeah, well, there's no middle ground on Walt Disney. That's one of the interesting things you find, is that almost no one, I mean, I found no one who's ambivalent about Walt Disney. You either love him or you hate him. And those camps actually, one can describe those camps because they don't cut across all parts of America or all different classes. The intellectuals primarily dislike Walt Disney. And Richard Schickel has become kind of the spearhead for that view of Walt Disney, that he is not a folk artist, but actually a Kitschmeister, someone who debased, as I said earlier, popular culture by manufacturing its products. A man who, as Schickel describes him, couldn't even sign his own name. That is the company logo that we see, that script, which was actually kind of designed for Walt Disney. So you have that vision of Walt Disney on one side. On the other side, you have the vision of Walt Disney that's more or less represented by Bob Thomas's biography.
That's
an American original, which is the authorized studio biography written some years ago. And in that biography, you get the view of Walt Disney as being a kind of Horatio Alger figure who pulled himself up by his own bootstraps and who provided in the process this wonderful vision of America, which now informs all of our lives. And Richard Schickel actually kind of fires a shot across the bow of that vision of Disney by saying that Walt Disney appeals to the subliterates of America. There was always a kind of condescension about Walt Disney, even when intellectuals embraced him in the 1930s, as they did. They embraced him because they saw him as this kind of artistic naif, someone who was completely without pretension, someone who was young and uneducated and really was a folk artist. And that image of Walt Disney began, or that feeling about Walt Disney, which was encapsulated in that image, began to turn in the 1940s, particularly with the production of Fantasia. Because what Fantasia demonstrated is that Walt Disney did have pretensions. In fact, that he wasn't a completely unaffected fellow. That Walt Disney did see his animations as art in blending the classical music with his animation. So at that point, you begin to see certain critics beginning for the first time to take off against Walt Disney and to begin criticizing him for not being that innocent fellow they thought he was.
And let's focus more on that time, because when we go to the 1930s, we're generally talking about movies that people don't see much anymore, the old black and white and the early color Disney cartoons. And as you talk about it in your biography, this was a time when he was an intellectual darling, but also very commercially popular, working in a form that was pretty much considered the filler of the bill at the movie theater.
Yes, it was. And Walt Disney really chafed at that description. Because very early on, Walt Disney felt the only way that he could really get his foothold in the animation business was to make animations that were better quality than any rival's animations. But there was also a psychological impulse. It wasn't only a business decision. Psychologically, Walt Disney wanted very much to make more realistic animations. And the whole push of Walt Disney Animation throughout the 1930s, culminating with Snow White in 1937, is a push toward greater realism. Now, before Walt Disney, you look at animations, and if somebody's running, the legs move and the arms move, but nothing else moves. There's no sense of realism. You're clearly watching a drawing. What Walt Disney introduced is the notion of secondary effects, so that not only the arms and the legs move, but the clothing moves, the hair moves. You get a sense of gravity acting on the body, a sense of mass. All of those things were things that Walt Disney introduced to animation in the service of getting greater realism. And the idea of getting greater realism was also so he could elicit better responses from the audience. Because Walt Disney always felt, you know, there's no reason why animation shouldn't be the rival of live-action films, doing all the things that live-action films do, eliciting all the responses that live-action films can elicit. And that was really kind of the test that Walt Disney set for himself in the 1930s. And it culminated with Snow White, because in Snow White, he set himself the greatest test, and really the test of realism itself, which is, can you get an audience not only to laugh at cartoons, which they were doing throughout the 30s, but can you get them to cry? If you can get an audience to cry the way they cry at live-action pictures, then you've really accomplished something.
Did he succeed in doing that?
Oh, yes, he did. I mean, that opening night in December 1937 at the Carthay Circle Theater in Los Angeles was the testing point. And Walt had all along felt, and if you read the story meeting transcripts, and by the way, virtually all of those story meetings were transcribed. There was a stenographer there, and those were then mimeographed and distributed to the studio so that everyone in the studio could know what Walt Disney was thinking, which would enable them then to fulfill Walt Disney's vision. But if you look at those story meeting notes, Walt at one point says, look, this is how we're going to do it. We'll have Snow White on her bier, and she'll be surrounded by the dwarves. And the dwarves will just be standing there silently. And only one of the dwarves will cry, Grumpy. Just a single tear will go down his cheek, and that will kill them, he said. Well, of course, he was right. There was a certain amount of anticipation. Would the audience cry when the dwarves cried? And they did. And that was a triumphant moment. Now, I might add here that scarcely 10 years earlier, Walt and his fellow employees were wondering whether an audience would even buy the idea of a voice emanating from drawings. You know, a voice emanates from people, but do drawings talk? Today we take it for granted. Of course, we watch an animation. We know that a voice can come from animations. But they actually debated whether an audience could suspend their disbelief enough to know that a voice was coming from a drawing. So here we are 10 years later, and they're not only buying that a voice is coming from a drawing, they're buying that these are real, living, feeling, breathing entities about which the audience is shedding their own tears.
We're talking with Neil Gabler. He's the author of Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination, a new biography of Disney published by Alfred A. Knopf. You may also know him as the author of a biography on Walter Winchell and books such as Life, the Movie, How Entertainment Conquered Reality, and An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. And if you'd like to ask a question of Neil Gabler, you can call us here at the Afternoon Magazine, locally at 333-9455. That's 333-9455. Or call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Now, you know, from looking through your book, there seem to be an awful lot of anecdotes here about how Walt Disney could be a really terrible person to work for.
I mean, yes, he was not an easy man to work for.
Possibly the worst manager ever, I get the idea. Not a people person at all, but at the same
time. No, he was not. I'll tell you why, because he saw people in very instrumental terms.
Mm-hmm.
He saw people as fulfilling his vision. He was completely dedicated to his animations and later to his theme parks. And if you could help him realize that vision, then you were, you know, you had a job for life. But if you didn't help him realize that vision, or if you could no longer help him realize that vision, even if you had once done so, Wolf was not a sentimentalist. He had a word for those people who no longer facilitated his visions, is deadwood.
And it wasn't just a matter of talent. It was a matter of being on his wavelength, it sounded like.
Yes, of course, talent he respected tremendously. But no matter how talented you were really not a collaborator of Walt Disney's. You know, since his death, a number of the animators have talked about themselves as essentially being in collaboration with Walt Disney. These are very talented men, these animators, great artists in their own right, but they were not collaborators with Walt Disney. Walt Disney had no collaborator. Walt Disney would tell his animators what he wanted, and then it would be their job to approximate as best they could what Walt Disney had in his head. That's the way the studio operated. And for a very long time, and I use this word in the book, in fact, it's the title of one of the chapters, the studio operated not like any other business, not like any other studio. It operated like a cult, with Walt Disney at the head of the cult, and all of his employees, essentially his acolytes. They worshipped Walt Disney. They would do anything Walt Disney asked. They would work 7 days a week because Walt Disney wanted them to. They would work until midnight because Walt Disney wanted them to. When they were rushing Snow White to its completion, their hands and arms were burnt by the lights on the animation tables because Walt Disney wanted them to get that animation completed. And at a point, they were having a very difficult time moving their drawings, that is, the animators, from their drawing table to what was known as ink and paint, where it was actually traced onto a celluloid panel and then painted so it could be photographed by the camera. They were having a hard time moving those drawings on because the animators themselves felt the quality wasn't high enough for Walt Disney. Walt Disney's standards were so high that they felt they weren't meeting them. So this is the awe, the reverence in which they held Walt Disney, who was a very young man, by the way, at this time. Walt Disney invented Mickey Mouse when he was 26 years old. He releases Snow White when he's 35 years old. So he's a very young man throughout this period, and yet he operates as something more than a king, as something almost close to a god at his own studio.
I want to get back to that in a moment. We do have a caller coming in, a caller on a cell phone, and I want to say good afternoon. You're on the Afternoon Magazine.
Good afternoon. My question actually has to do with later in Walt's life, and his theme park operations, the Florida project. Does your book cover that?
Oh, yes, it does. Absolutely.
Okay. Specifically, as I understood it, Walt had a rather grander vision for the Florida project and what ultimately came of it. And having seen some of the footage from his television show describing what he was intending to do versus the finished product, I wonder just how devoted were the people who worked with him to that project at the time when he was living, considering the changes that occurred to that project following his death?
That's a very good question, and the answer is they were very devoted to that project, and the project was this. Walt Disney had no interest in Walt Disney World, none whatsoever. You know, Walt Disney was a been-there-done-that kind of guy, and he'd already
right.
built his theme park in Disneyland. So Walt Disney World held no appeal for him. What Walt Disney World would enable him to do is provide the revenue so that he could build Epcot. And Epcot was really Walt's passion at the end of his life. Not Epcot as it now exists, which is essentially a glorified World's Fair, but Walt Disney's vision of Epcot was of a fully operational city of the future with a population of 100,000, the very latest in technology, which Walt would then export to the rest of the country and around the world. So this city would be a kind of laboratory for new technologies and for new policies in social engineering, because at the end of his life, Walt saw himself and his legacy, I might add, because Walt was really thinking of what his legacy would be. He saw himself as an urban designer and a social engineer. Now, you ask, how devoted were his employees to this vision? They were very devoted to it. They worked very closely with Walt to design Epcot. And indeed, one of the last things that Walt did before he died was film a kind of promotional presentation of what Epcot would look like. But after Walt's death, Marty Sklar, who was one of the Imagineers and actually wrote that presentation, that Walt presented.
Sure.
Came to Roy Disney, and he said, you know, we really got to move on Epcot. I mean, this was Walt's legacy. And Roy's answer was, Marty, Walt's dead. And so was Epcot.
And
so you posit that it's really Roy who kind of took, retasked the company, so to speak, to look at it more from an entertainment angle than a vision of
yes.
tomorrow.
Roy was always in the position of having to find the resources to fund Walt's vision. And that was the way that the two brothers partnered throughout their entire lives. The studio began, in fact, in 1923 as Disney Brothers Studio. And Walt suddenly changed the name of the studio without any protest from his brother Roy to Walt Disney Productions. And Roy was always charged with getting the money to do what Walt wanted to do. But now that Walt was dead, Roy didn't have to do that anymore. And you may see this as kind of his final protest. I don't know whether it was really that or whether it was just that Roy was beholden to the stockholders, and he didn't feel that without Walt there, Epcot could really take off. Epcot needed Walt Disney to shepherd it through to completion. There was no one else who had the vision or the passion for the project. And indeed, when it was built, as I say, it bore no resemblance whatsoever to what Walt's vision of Epcot was.
Neil, wasn't there a town developed by the Disney Company in later
Celebration,
years?
Florida.
Doesn't
have some of the earmarks of Walt's idea for Epcot, but it is more or less just a kind of idealized community, whereas Walt had much larger ambitions for Epcot. What Walt's ambition for Epcot was to have not just an idealized community, but a perfect community technologically and socially. And he tried to design all of these elements, a transportation system, a refuse collection system, even churches and recreation. Walt was trying to think of everything. He even thought about how to protect the community from juvenile delinquency, what to do with senior citizens. There was nothing that Walt Disney wasn't thinking about in those last 2 years of his life that wasn't somehow dedicated to the realization of Epcot.
Well, caller, thank you very much for bringing that question up. I do want to move ahead to another caller who's been waiting patiently from Champaign on line two. And good afternoon. You're on the Afternoon Magazine.
Good afternoon. I would like to ask the gentleman, what was Walt Disney's racial views? I've done a little bit of research on Walt Disney, and I came away thinking that he was very much a racist, and I'd like for the guest to respond if he has any knowledge of that.
Well, I do, because, of course, you know, I went through all the materials, particularly around the time that he was making Song of the South, which is the film that really raises this issue. You know, if you ask me whether Walt Disney was a racist, I would say no. In my estimation, I mean, obviously, racial sensitivities were very different in the 1940s 1930s than they are today.
Yes.
And Walt Disney certainly partook of those racial insensitivities. There's no question about that. And Song of the South is an example of his racial insensitivity. But if you ask me whether he was a racist, whether he espoused any kind of racial theories, whether he felt that whites were racially superior, whether he ever used racial epithets, never. Not anywhere can I find any of that. And indeed, when he was making Song of the South, as insensitive, I think, as that film ultimately is in many respects, Walt tried, by his own rights, to protect the film from those kinds of insensitivities by sending the script to a number of black leaders and black intellectuals and have them vet the script. Some of them did, some of them did not. But Walt knew that the material could be incendiary, and yet he went on and made the film anyway. And again, I think there was a certain obtuseness about Walt Disney, but not a racism.
Now, there's a question connected to that, which has been raised, about whether Walt Disney was anti-Semitic.
Yeah, that's a more complicated issue, and I discuss that at some length in the book. And let me just give you the short version, because there are a number of reasons why Walt Disney was regarded as anti-Semitic. I'll give you what I think is the final analysis why that charge has seemed to stick with him. And that is that Walt Disney, after his studio was struck in 1941 by the Screen Cartoonists Guild, became vehemently anti-communist because he believed that there were communist elements in the Screen Cartoonists Guild that had fomented the strike. In 1944, a group of anti-communists in Hollywood formed an organization called the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals. Walt joined that organization, and not only joined that organization, he was invited to join it, in point of fact, not only joined it, but he became a vice president of that organization. That organization was widely regarded in Hollywood, not only as an anti-communist organization, but also as an anti-Semitic organization. That a number of the leaders of that group, not Walt Disney, but people like Rupert Hughes and Adolf Manju, were regarded as anti-Semites. Walt must have known, and I say this in the book, he must have known that these men were regarded as anti-Semites, and yet he allowed himself to be used by them, and he allowed himself to associate with them. So even though I do not believe that Walt Disney was an anti-Semite, I do not find any evidence that Walt Disney ever made anti-Semitic remarks, that Walt Disney ever displayed any hostility toward Jews, and there were Jews who worked at the studio, and I interviewed several of them, including Joe Grant, who was a longtime employee at the studio and who wrote Dumbo. And I was rather prosecutorial with Joe Grant, as I was with Harry Teitel, another Jew who worked at the studio for a very long time, from 1937 and until Walt's death in 1966, and I said, look, was there any evidence of anti-Semitism? Did you ever hear Walt make an anti-Semitic remark? Did you ever feel uncomfortable in Walt's presence because you were Jewish? And they insisted they did not. They insisted that just simply was not true. On the other hand, Walt did associate with this group of anti-Semites, and that guilt by association was something that he had a very, very difficult time expunging, in my estimation.
I want to thank the caller for his question. That brings up, you know, Walt Disney's place in the Hollywood film industry. You've written a whole book about about the Jewish immigrants who founded a lot of the Hollywood film industry. Walt Disney was a man who came sort of from the back door of Hollywood through cartoons. He was not Jewish. He was not an immigrant. And he was the little guy who didn't have his own distribution until, I guess, the 1950s or so. So he was always battling for control of his product. And some of those battles were pretty dramatic, certainly in his view. Where might that place him as far as how he got along with American Jews in the film industry?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the other Hollywood moguls loved Walt Disney because he really wasn't in competition with them. He was only releasing one feature a year, if that, and of course that was only in the late 1930s after Snow White. So he was really not an active competitor.
Releasing short cartoons was not considered because all the studios released short cartoons.
They all released short cartoons, and short cartoons were regarded as filler. Only the Walt Disney Company subsisted financially on the revenues from those cartoons. No other studio did. The other studios, you know, made some money from them, but not much. Some of the time, they actually took a loss on those cartoons. So Walt Disney was regarded as something of an oddity, but he was very much revered by most of the other Hollywood moguls. He certainly was not regarded as an outsider or an odd man out or any kind of marginalized individual in the motion picture industry. In point of fact, he was embraced.
What did they think of him in later years as he did branch out into more live-action feature films and also went into television a few years before the big studios did?
Well, you know, in later years, of course, the moguls were gone by the time that Walt Disney made his final or his biggest thrust into live-action films. But television is a very interesting threshold because the studios had held back from forming any kind of alliance with television, seeing television in the 1950s as an adversary, not an ally. Walt Disney thought very differently about television. He had been thinking about television very early on. And in fact, in 1936, when he was negotiating a deal with United Artists, a distribution deal with United Artists, United Artists insisted on retaining television rights. And Walt Disney thought that was a deal breaker, and indeed it was a deal breaker, because Walt Disney wanted to retain the television rights to all of his animations. So he was thinking about television long before he actually entered television. But Walt Disney was the first studio mogul to form an alliance with television when he formed his alliance with ABC and presented the Disneyland television program every Sunday night, beginning in 1954. Now, he formed that alliance, I should add here, because he needed financing for Disneyland. And the only way he could get financing for Disneyland was to have ABC underwrite the park, which is what they did. ABC was the third of the three networks. ABC had not a single program in the top 25 highest-rated programs. So it needed Walt Disney. And Walt Disney needed ABC for its financial powers to underwrite the theme park. And that's why the deal was formed. And that opened the floodgates, really, for all the other studios the very next year to begin marching through and realizing that television could indeed be an ally and another source of revenue rather than be an enemy of the motion picture industry.
The other studios started getting into television, but it seemed to be only Walt Disney who had this strong, identifiable brand. I certainly remember watching the Disney anthology show hosted by Walt Disney during the last years of his life as a kid. And you knew when a Disney program was a Disney program.
Well, Disney clearly branded his material, personally branded his material, as you pointed out, with himself as the host. And he became as much a corporate logo as Mickey Mouse or as that fanciful script of his name, Walt Disney. Walt Disney saw himself as an image. And he realized very much that, because he was self-aware, there was a great deal of self-awareness to Walt Disney, not introspection, but self-awareness. He was aware of the distance between the Walt Disney on television and Walt Disney the man. As he once said, you know, I'm not Walt Disney. You know, Walt Disney is a thing. He told someone else that Walt Disney is like Kleenex. It's generic. You know, he said, you know, Walt Disney doesn't smoke. I smoke. Walt Disney doesn't drink. I drink. So he understood that Walt Disney was no longer just a man. It was something much, much larger. And he understood his own personal relationship to that much larger entity. And it's that entity that most of us think of when we think of Walt Disney, that avuncular fellow, you know, on Sunday evenings, or Wednesday evenings when the program was originally broadcast. But that is not really Walt Disney.
But that's essentially the character. That's what he was selling.
That's the character he was playing and the image he sold. But, you know, on the jacket of my book, I have a picture of Walt Disney from the early 1930s.
He looks like he doesn't look like Uncle Walt at all in this
picture.
No,
he looks somewhat like a movie star. He's lit rather glamorously. His hair is slicked back on his head. You know, he still has his mustache, his trademark mustache, which he grew in 1924 and didn't shave off but twice in that entire period until the end of his life. But he's a very different figure. The Walt Disney of the 1930s and 40s, and the real Walt Disney, is a very different figure than the image Walt Disney of the 1950s and 1960s.
We're talking with Neil Gabler, the author of Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination, published by Alfred A. Knopf. And we have a caller in on line one from Champaign. Good afternoon. You're on the Afternoon Magazine.
Hi. I hope this isn't too far off the subject. Do you have anything in the book about the animators who formed the Firehouse 5 plus 2 Dixieland Band?
I sure do.
Ward Kimball.
Ward Kimball, absolutely. That group, Walt was always looking for ways to create a sense of community at the studio, because Walt was just as interested in the process of making the animations as he was in the animations himself. And one of the reasons, as an earlier caller asked about Epcot, one of the reasons he was so interested in Epcot was that Walt was fascinated by social processes, by the way that people related to one another. And he was just as fascinated by that within his own studio. So that one really has to look at kind of two art forms that Walt Disney was creating. He was creating the animations, but he was also creating the art form of how those animators would relate to one another in making the animations. And one of those elements was the Firehouse 5 plus 2, which was a jazz band, Dixieland jazz band, that was formed by a number of the animators, that would perform at the studio, would perform at functions for the studio, and would actually perform outside the studio. It would have gigs in various, you know, in the surrounding area of Los Angeles. Wald thought that that gave a creative outlet to his animators, but also formed a greater sense of community among his animators. Now, I should add that there was some resentment against the Firehouse Five, a plus two, by some of the other animators who felt that they had been given special privileges by Wald. And this was just one of the many breaches that opened in the 1940s among the animators that ruined that sense of community that Walt Disney was striving so hard to create. I mean, the strike obviously was the major reason why that sense of community shattered. But even a little thing like the forming of a Dixieland jazz band could create fissures within the company.
Caller, thank you very much. We're some of the callers are starting to line up now on the program, and let's go to line four in Eureka. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. A very interesting program. There was a report maybe in the last 1 to 3 years about some kind of connection between Walt Disney and some sort of right-wing circles. I don't know whether it was a House on Un-American Activities Committees or I don't think it was the CIA. Could you comment on any of this? And if
sure.
you found anything on that in your research, please.
Yes, well, you're probably referring to several things. One, Walt did testify as a friendly witness before the House Committee on Un-American Activities in 1947. Now, he couldn't really name names because there were no names to name. Walt was very angry about that strike, and again, he believed that communist elements had fomented that strike. So when he spoke before the House Committee, I mean, he was fulminating about communist infiltration into Hollywood. But oddly enough, he misspoke in one of the few groups that he did name or did identify as communist. He called the League of Women Voters a communist front, which it clearly was not then and is not now. And he actually had misspoken. He meant to identify a group called the League of Women Shoppers, which had called for a boycott of the Disney Studio product during the strike. And Walt was very reluctant to recant, but he finally did. Now, another thing you're probably referring to is that Walt has been identified as an informant for the FBI.
Okay.
You know, to a certain extent, you know, he was an informant, if by informant you mean that he submitted names of his employees in a certain period of time for clearance to the FBI to prove that they weren't communists.
Before
every studio did that. There was actually a blacklist, as you know, that was instituted in 1947 in Hollywood. So Walt was no different than anybody else in doing that. On the other hand, Walt Disney was a somewhat reluctant, not a reluctant anti-communist, but he was somewhat a reluctant blacklister because he had hired Maurice Rapp, who had been a member of the Communist Party, to do a rewrite on Song of the South. And Rapp came to Walt and he said, you know, Mr. Disney, you know my politics. I you know, so before we go any farther, I know you're an anti-communist, and, you know, I'm obviously very left. And Walt said, that's exactly why I hired you. I hired you because I thought you will do a pass on Song of the South, and you'll take out anything that's Uncle Tom in it. And I think that indicates something about Walt Disney, which is this. Walt Disney would have hired anybody if he thought that that person would help him realize his vision on screen. Walt didn't use politics, or anything else for that matter, against the person he was hiring if that person would help Walt Disney realize his vision, which is all Walt Disney cared about.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, caller. Let's go ahead to line two, a caller from Kankakee. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Would the guest please expand on the experimental prototype community of tomorrow, Epcot? Walt Disney as a visionary and futurologist, and whether the Disney company carries on in the same visionary pattern. And does Walt Disney's thought give us any kind of a paradigm for improving life on Earth? Thank you.
Well, I'll give you a little bit more about Epcot. I talked about it briefly earlier. I mean, as Walt Disney saw Epcot, it was a city designed in concentric circles. And those concentric circles, there would be at the middle of all of these concentric circles, sort of at the bullseye of the target would be a downtown area. And then there would be bands around that downtown area, a recreation area, a residential area, another recreation area, and there would be spokes radiating out from the center to the final circle. And these spokes would have the transportation system on them, which Walt saw as people movers, which were small electric trains. And so that's kind of how he visualized the physical layout of the city. There would be a highway or a roadway underneath the city so that you wouldn't see cars. And all the waste collection, almost all of the infrastructure, would be underground so that it wouldn't mar the surface. At one point, Walt even considered enclosing the entire city under a giant plastic bubble so it would be impervious to the weather. So that gives you some general sense of how Walt was conceptualizing the city. Now, I'll point out here, too, one of the great problems that Walt had begun to consider but never finally had to resolve because, of course, he died before Epcot was built, and that was Walt saw this city as the product of his own imagination. But we live in a democracy, and the problem that Walt himself had to begin to debate was, what do you do about the population, which, as I said earlier, at some points he said would be as many as 100,000 inhabitants? How would they exercise their democratic rights in an entity where Walt Disney wanted to retain ultimate control? Walt never quite reconciled those two ideas of his ultimate control with their democratic rights. But that gives you some hint of one of the real stumbling blocks to making Epcot a fully realizable community. Now, you asked me whether the Walt Disney Company still has this in its DNA, and I guess to the extent that Celebration Florida, as an earlier caller mentioned, you know, exists, I guess it still is in the company's DNA to some extent. But Walt Disney was a real futurist, and I don't think that anyone in the Walt Disney Company quite has the futurist kind of vision that Walt Disney had.
Thank you very much, caller. I think we have time for one more caller. Line 3 out of Champaign. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Yes. I may be wrong about this, but I think that the current Walt Disney films include violence, and there's something else that they include, I think. I wondered whether Walt Disney ever approved of violence in his films.
Well, there's some violence in some of his films. Even Davy Crockett has violence in it. I mean, Walt was very protective of his brand because he knew what he was doing. He knew that at some point in his career, he'd become kind of captive of the image of Walt Disney, and that there were certain kinds of films that he felt he couldn't make, not necessarily because he didn't want to make them, to be perfectly honest with you, but because he knew that the audience wouldn't accept them from him. I tell the story in the book where he has had a screening of To Kill a Mockingbird at his house. And after the film is over, he laments, you know, I wish I could make that movie. But he knew that he couldn't make that kind of movie because Walt Disney movies were not like To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, Walt Disney movies had to be almost wholly without any kind of edge to them after a time. The interesting thing is that early on, when you look at those early animations, not only the Mickey Mouse's, but even the feature animations like Snow White and Pinocchio and Fantasia and Bambi, are quite edgy and are not at all the lightness and froth that Walt Disney is often accused of having produced. I mean, there is, after all, Bambi's mother's death. There is the separation between Dumbo and his mother. There's the flight through the woods in Snow White. There's Pinocchio and Pleasure Island. These are not the kind of wholly wholesome, treacly images that one associates with Walt Disney. When you go through his papers, you find a lot of letters from parents protesting the way in which Walt Disney's films have scared their children. And Walt always said that he didn't make movies for children. You know, he said that, you know, he made movies for adults who took their children to them. But he never thought primarily in terms of children.
Neil Gabler, we are just about out of time now, and so we're going to have to drop it there. But I think just the topic of Walt Disney and the place of him and his movies in the American imagination is something you can talk about for a long time. The book is Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Neil Gabler, thank you very much for being on the show with me here in the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you so much, and thank your listeners as well.